Good morning. It's 8:06 on this Monday morning, May 4th. 36 degrees here in Old Town Park City under mostly sunny skies. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning. So may the 4th be with you. I think that's what everybody's saying today. So kind of exciting. We have a great stretch of weather. So we're going to be under the influence of a high pressure system. We're currently at about 1,007 millibars, but the good news is we're quickly increasing as far as that high pressure goes. So we're going to see high, dry conditions for this week. So we are going to hit mid-50s today, the coolest day of the week. We're going to see mid-60s by tomorrow. A few clouds late Tuesday and early Wednesday. There's a trough that kind of just clips us off to the north and east, but it will be dry with associated cold fronts. So temps are going to dip just a little bit. Upper 50s on Thursday, and then mid-60s by Friday. It's going to be a dry week. Now, I don't like that because we certainly could use some water, so I'm hoping for that precip that I'm looking at for the following Monday to Tuesday. Otherwise, the big weekend forecast includes Mother's Day, where we're seeing plenty of sunshine. Temperatures on Saturday are flirting with the 70s, and on Sunday, we may actually hit 70 degrees with lots of sunshine. So a very nice weekend in the forecast, but of course, I am also tracking that precip because we could use that here. We're at 59% of normal as far as our reservoir values go. So hopefully we'll get some rain by next week. In the meantime, enjoy all the sunshine.
Okay. Thanks, Erica. KPCW News Time now, 8:07. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be talking with employment attorney Mark Tolman. We'll be talking about employee rights now that businesses are reopening. The co-chairs of the May 7th Peace House Spring Luncheon, Julie Joyce and Kate Margolis, have details about how you can participate in this virtual lunch. And then finally, Rob Harder, the executive director of the Christian Center of Park City, has details about the services his organization is offering during this COVID-19 crisis. Taking a look at local news now, several local nonprofits have been working under the umbrella of the Park City Community Foundation to help vulnerable residents impacted by COVID-19. And although the needs of their clients are different, KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that one major item impacting everybody is housing.
The Community Foundation hosted an electronic meeting last week before Summit County passed a revised health order that lifted the stay-at-home directive. Foundation Executive Director Katie Wright said they have raised about $1.2 million since mid-March for their Community Response Fund. She predicted they will need about $2.7 million for local nonprofits to get to the point of recovery. The foundation's new Community Impact Director is Diego Zagara, who said they know housing and rent is a major concern for everybody.
Through a survey earlier this month, we learned that 93% of the families that we partner with through the Solomon Fund had either lost their jobs or experienced a significant reduction in hours. And just as a reminder for everyone, not everyone in this group qualifies for federal unemployment or a stimulus check. We also learned that the biggest concern was rent. It was shared by over 75% of the folks that responded to the survey. The Community Response Fund has so far deployed almost a third of the funds it has raised in about a month and a half, totaling $360,000.
He added they are negotiating with large landowners in the community in order to help tenants who are pressed for rent payments. Ellen Silver from Jewish Family Services gave an example of a family they're helping. She gave the mother a fictitious name, Eva.
But Eva has been a mental health client at Jewish Families for some time, dealing with some anxiety that comes from early life experiences. She and her husband have three children. They live in their own apartment. They immediately, when the resorts closed, they within days lost their jobs in a hotel they both work for. They won't be eligible for a stimulus check. They won't be eligible for collecting unemployment necessarily either. And they were off the rails about how they were going to meet their expenses.
From Park City Peace House, Kendra Wyckoff said they've seen an uptick in calls about domestic abuse since the coronavirus shutdown. The demand for their emergency shelter has intensified. During this quarter, the average stay at the shelter has increased from 30 days to 60 days. Several clients have also been torn between their desire to get away from an abusive situation and their COVID concerns about a communal situation at the Peace House. Wyckoff said they tried to come up with a solution.
We're using our transitional housing units right now as emergency shelter to mitigate risk. And I think that has really helped, especially with an increase in the average length of stay being double what it has historically been. It, one, helps reduce exposure to COVID-19 across families that are residing in our program, and also just creates maybe a more comfortable situation where they have a self-contained unit where they can use their own kitchen and living space.
And from the Park City Education Foundation, Abby McNulty talked about a different kind of housing problem. When the aspiring students of their Bright Futures program lose access to a school environment.
And that's a program initiative of the Ed Foundation that supports first-generation college students get to and through college. One of the things that they're reporting to us is that they don't have the physical space to have quiet, to be able to study, and to be able to engage in the online learning that exists. So these could be high school seniors or college freshmen. They just are not able to find a quiet space. There's lots of family members living in small apartments, perhaps multiple families living in small apartments.
Abby McNulty from the Park City Education Foundation. For KPCW, I'm Rick Brough.
Well, while Utah is entering the stabilization phase in the pandemic, the state health department is focusing efforts on hotspots. KPCW's David Boyle has more on the state's new strike teams.
Part of the state's strategy to safely open up the economy includes identifying and responding to hotspots. State epidemiologist Dr. Angela Dunn says the Utah Health Department has created strike teams to address outbreaks in the state.
These teams will consist of mobile testing teams, investigators to identify the exposure, and then support services to ensure that those who need to isolate and quarantine are able to do so.
Strike teams will allow the state to focus resources to areas most impacted by COVID-19.
Identifying hotspots is something we've done from the beginning of this outbreak. It's bread and butter public health in terms of responding to any infectious disease outbreak. For example, at the beginning, we knew that Summit County was a hotspot, and that's where all of the cases were at the initial part of this. Now we have certain neighborhoods in both Utah County and Salt Lake County that have high rates of infection, and we're working with those local health departments to understand why and respond and stop the spread. The strike teams will be made up of state employees, both a mix of logistics experts, medical experts, and epidemiologists, both at the state and local levels, so that we can appropriately respond to any of the hotspots.
At Friday's briefing, Dr. Dunn said they had employed the first strike force at a residential facility in Utah County that serves intellectually disabled adults. 15 of the 40 residents have tested positive for COVID-19, as well as 9 staff members.
They don't typically have nursing level care there. It is more of an intermediate care facility. Because of this spread of disease within the facility, our strike team is providing that level of nursing care, in addition to medical supplies that they don't routinely stock there, including PPE, to be able to care for the ill residents in that facility and then also prevent further spread.
Dunn says they're also working to make these resources available to non-English-speaking communities. I'm David Boyle, KPCW News.
8:15. Well, last Friday, certain businesses in Utah reopened as the state lifted some of the restrictions put into place to stop the spread of COVID-19. But not everyone loves the idea, including some employees who are being called back to the workplace while the pandemic is still going on. What rights do they have if they return to work and get sick? Well, we invited employment attorney Mark Tolman of Jones Walden to answer some of those questions. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Leslie.
So we have already seen a number of employees show up to work every day, never even taken a day off during the pandemic since it, the stay-at-home orders were issued. But there are others now who have been off work, and if they want to keep their job, are being forced to show up. So what's the deal? Can an employer force you to work in what could be dangerous conditions?
Yes. Let me make a caveat. An employer cannot force an employee to work in a dangerous condition. And OSHA has provided a number of guidelines for employers to adjust their workplaces to make them safe in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. But if employers have done so and their workplaces are safe and they invite their employees to come back to work and their employees refuse, they're not going to have many rights in that situation. They may be able to be fired in that situation.
Okay. So what steps, as we kind of go back to work, should an employee be taking at this point?
An employee?
Correct.
Well, I think an employee would want to ask their employer about their, flexible workplace policies. I think how to report if they are feeling sick. I think they would want to know what their employer has done to implement basic infection prevention measures. I think employees have a right to ask those types of questions to ensure that their employers are following the guidelines the government has provided to make workplaces safe.
Okay, and then for employers then, they just need to make sure that they're following all of the guidelines put into place?
Yeah, easier said than done. There's quite a bit to know and to read there. But I think employers should start by very seriously considering their own level of risk associated with their particular work site. Whether employees are going to be exposed to the public and customers, how to control risk factors associated with employees who are high risk. And then I think employers also need to thoughtfully prepare to implement basic infection prevention protocols. Things like promoting frequent hand washing, making sure workers who are sick are encouraged to stay home. And more than just telling people that are sick to stay home, to really encourage employees to stay home, I think employers need to be smart about adopting flexible sick leave policies so employees know that if they are feeling sick, they're not going to lose their job if they don't show up to work.
Right. And then for some, it's certainly the case that they're now making more money on unemployment than they actually were on the job. So I guess there's some, talk to us if a business does open and an employee refuses to show up. It sounds like they can be fired. What's the difference here? I mean, would the employer then say, well, no, you're quitting because you're not showing up, or the employee saying, I quit? So, I mean, because there's a difference when it comes to collecting unemployment, right?
Yes, there is, Leslie. And you know what? This question you just asked me is such a common question. I think I've been asked that question by employer clients a dozen times over the last week. And so it is a common problem. There are a number of employees who are faced with this issue of coming back to work and taking a pay cut to do so. But if they're invited to come back to work, then they're no longer furloughed. They're no longer in a laid off position. And if they decline that invitation, they will lose their eligibility for unemployment benefits.
Okay. And then if they got sick at work, and I guess I'm really thinking of the meatpacking folks that we saw, they went down in numbers. Could an employee then sue their employer for getting sick?
Well, not exactly, no. They could not sue their employer in court unless they could show that the employer acted intentionally to cause them to be sick. That would be a rare situation indeed. But there is a mechanism for them to get redress for their workplace illness or injury, and that's through the workers' compensation system. So here in the state of Utah, if an employee gets sick and believes that their illness was caused at work, what they would do is they would reach out to the Utah Labor Commission and file a workers' compensation claim there.
And how is that something? I mean, how could you possibly prove that?
Well, that would be a very difficult thing to do. We've seen our legislature address that issue last week with adopting legislation for healthcare workers to say to a healthcare worker who gets COVID-19, we're just going to go ahead and assume that you contracted COVID-19 at work. But for someone who does not work in the health industry, frankly, Leslie, that is going to be difficult for them to show. Not impossible, but difficult.
Hmm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some of those, the legislation. You were mentioning I think it was House Bill 3007. That's the one that made it easier for first responders to get workman's comp if they should contract COVID-19 on the job?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And then there's another bill that passed through the legislature that's awaiting the governor's signature. That's Senate Bill 3007, which is an immunity measure that says to businesses that reopen, people that come onto those premises and feel like they contracted COVID-19 there, that there's immunity for those persons who operate businesses from lawsuits, unless they can show the individual who got sick could show that the individual acted recklessly or willfully or intentionally to harm them. But that immunity bill, SB 3007, doesn't really change workplace liabilities at all. In fact, it expressly says that this immunity bill does not modify at all the provisions of the Workers' Compensation Act. It was already the case in Utah that an employee whose boss acted intentionally to harm them could sue that boss in court. But absent a showing of some sort of intentional misconduct, the exclusive remedy has been for years and years and continues to be for workplace illness and injury to file a claim for workers' compensation benefits.
Okay. And then I also heard news over the weekend on the federal level, something similar, Senate Leader Mitch McConnell trying to push through some legislation that would protect employers, and Chuck Schumer then, of course, countering, saying, you know what, we've got to check, you know, we've got to make sure that the employees are protected as well. I don't know if you're familiar with this.
You know, I'm not familiar with it, Leslie. I'd be shocked if legislation like that passed through at the federal level to immunize employers or to take away the rights of employees to at least seek workers' compensation benefits. I don't know how seriously we need to take proposals like that. I can't imagine that workers' compensation benefits are going anyplace.
All right. So where can people get help, especially if they don't have the resources to hire an attorney to get the answers they're looking for?
Well, employers ought to go immediately to OSHA's website. They ought to Google OSHA guidance on preparing workplaces for COVID-19. Very, very helpful resource for employers that talks about developing an infectious disease response plan. It outlines the basic infection prevention measures and talks about developing policies and procedures to identify people who are sick. If I were an employer, that's the first place I would go, is go to OSHA's website and learn about how to make my workplace safe. If I were an employee, frankly, I'd go the same place, right? Because I'd want to know if my employer is being smart, if my employer is following federal and state guidelines to make workplaces safe. And then as an employee, if you believe that your workplace is not safe, that your employer has not implemented basic infection protocols, for example, there's physical distancing that is possible, but the employer is not doing it, believes that the employer should be providing personal protective equipment and is not doing so, that employee should reach out to the Utah Labor Commission, the occupational UOSH, Utah's version of OSHA, and file a complaint, a workplace safety complaint there.
Okay. Again, best advice, though, if employees do have concerns, they should be contacting their employer to let them know what those concerns are rather than just not showing up.
Oh, absolutely. They're going to lose their jobs if they just decide not to show up, and that's going to impact their ability to get benefits.
Okay. Hey, anything else that you think is important that people know?
Well, one more thing, Leslie. As employers that maybe have been have had employees furloughed, have not been operating over the last few weeks, they may have missed some very important federal laws, including the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, that provides paid leave to employees who get sick or caring for people who get sick with COVID, and also provides paid leave for employees who need to stay home because their child's school or daycare is closed. Perhaps employers missed those new federal laws, which require that they immediately post via email, intranet, regular mail, Department of Labor poster outlining these FFCRA paid leave rights. So if employers have missed that, or employees perhaps who've not been at work did not become aware of the FFCRA paid leave laws related to COVID-19 absences, they ought to make sure they're aware of those laws now.
And again, those are usually for businesses of, what, 50 or more employees?
No, the FFCRA applies to all companies that have fewer than 500 employees. So, Leslie, I think you just referred maybe to the Family Medical Leave Act, the FMLA. The FFCRA is a new law just passed in response to COVID-19 that expands the FMLA leave rights and also provides emergency paid sick leave rights to every employee of an employer with fewer than 500 employees.
Okay, that's most people in Park City then. Okay.
I would imagine so.
Yeah. Mark, hey, I appreciate your advice. We appreciate it.
Anytime, Leslie. Thanks so much.
That's Attorney Mark Tolman again with Jones Waldo. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the Dakota Pacific proposal is back on the schedule for the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. And Summit County Development Director Pat Putt is hoping it will get to an electronic public hearing by June. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more about that.
The Boyer Tett Park development was approved by the county in 2008 for a total of nearly 1.3 million square feet. Dakota Pacific acquired the land and came to the county last year with a mixed neighborhood design up to 1.8 million square feet, but the applicants returned to the Snyderville Commission on April 28th with a revision that's closer to Boyer's square footage. As Putt noted in his recent report to KPCW, the plan has more open space, less surface parking, and less density. The plan includes 1,100 residential units, 235,000 square feet of office space, a hotel of 122,000 square feet, and without, at this point, a new county civic center or an underground transit location. At the recent meeting, Snyderville commissioners discussed if the project is walkable.
From the initial review of what we looked at last night, internally, yeah, we think that there are some areas with that have some significant beneficial changes to it. You know, the sort of the pedestrian connection within the development proposal and how it connects to the broader neighborhood and open space and recreation areas around it and the services around it. So our initial reaction is a optimistic yes.
Planning commissioners also were concerned how pedestrians can get across Highway 224 safely. Putt noted that's an issue larger than just Dakota, and entities like the state are involved.
UDOT is underway with its corridor planning for the Interstate 80, 224 intersection and the corridor up the highway. So it's not precluded that we're not going to have, you know, a pedestrian crossing, whether that's a tunnel or a bridge. Where we are right now is somewhat agnostic of that. But the Planning Commission is very, very concerned that if we're going to introduce more residential units in that area, that they want to have a very viable and safe way of connecting people across to the east side.
The planning commissioners will have to consider if the 306 workforce housing units in the plan are appropriate and if they would worsen traffic impacts. And bottom line, Putt said they will have to consider if this plan is better than the old Boyer Tech Park concept.
Is the current plan that has a number of office tech buildings and surface parking lot, is that better than the plan they're bringing in that attempts to create more open space, less surface parking areas, arguably better neighborhood connectivity? Is that a better plan?
In the meantime, with the county conducting all its meetings electronically, Putt said they're working to make sure they can conduct effective public hearings on Zoom. To prepare for a larger meeting, Putt said they will have hearings in May on a couple of routine plat amendments. On some other developments, the Snyderville Commission at its last meeting picked Ryan Dickey as its chairman for the coming year, with Thomas Cook as vice chair. And Putt said contrary to what the public might expect, they're busy with applications. Those include a Canyons project, Vintage on the Strand, engaged in a do-over to get a final plat approval, in addition to small subdivision plats or accessory dwellings. And Putt said the Canyons Employee Housing has submitted its final plat for review and could break ground in June. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broth.
KPCW News Time now, 8:31. Good morning. Well, Peace House is hosting its virtual fundraiser this Thursday, May 7th, in place of the organization's annual spring luncheon. On the phone with me with details, I have the co-chairs of the event, Julie Joyce and Kate Margolis. Good morning to you, ladies.
Hey, good morning, Leslie.
So, Julie, do you want to start and just tell us what's going to happen? I mean, it's basically bring your own lunch, huh?
Well, it kind of is, unfortunately, because of the CDC guidelines advising against mass gatherings. We have moved our lunch online, and people can navigate to that from our website at peacehouse.org. But we have a lot of great videos. They're online now. We've got some more that we're going to host for the day of the event on May 7th, and it's an online day of giving to support Peace House.
Okay. So, Kate, what's going to happen? I mean, does everybody log in at the same time? Is it going to be a live event?
No. We have it up and running right now, so people could get on at their leisure. On the day of, we will have more to look at and hope that people will join in, but they don't have to be there a certain time. They can get up and have their coffee and be in their pajamas and get on our website and look at everything and really help us out. That would be great.
Okay, so the event is Thursday, May 7th. When will everything be up? By Thursday morning?
Everything will be up. Yes, actually, we're going to post it at midnight on Wednesday night.
Okay. And the link then will be right there on the homepage at peacehouse.org.
Yes, that's probably the easiest way to navigate it to it, peacehouse.org. This is really our most crucial fundraiser for Peace House. All proceeds go to support operational funding for our programs and services. The event raised $150,000 last year, and we'd like to meet or exceed that goal again this year.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, that is an ambitious goal, $150,000. So that's about what you've earned in past luncheons then, huh?
It is, but we're excited that we can announce a $50,000 matching grant for this event, which was generously donated by the Marriott Daughters Foundation. So right now, the next $50,000 that's donated will have double the impact.
Okay. And you've also received a few grants from the Christian Center, as well as Park City Municipal, and individual donations over the last 6-7 weeks. Is that money being counted towards this $150,000 goal?
No, it's not. And actually, we received grants from Park City Municipal and the Park City Community Foundation. They each granted us $10,000. And that was going specifically to our COVID-19 response. The funds from our spring luncheon really go to support all of our programs and services. Our 24/7 helpline, which we'd love your listeners to know, is still operating at 800-647-9161, as well as counseling, case management, and legal advocacy services.
So we have heard that we are seeing escalated violence due to the stay-at-home order. Can you put some numbers on that? I mean, are we talking like 5 more cases than you'd usually see this time of year? Are we talking much more than that?
I think the calls that we're getting in right now are of even much higher crisis than ever before. We do have at least 25% to 30% more calls coming in, and we are at capacity as far as the shelter goes. The other piece of this is that the clients are staying much longer than they used to because there's really nowhere else for them to go with the COVID-19 virus. So we are working as hard as possible to make sure that everybody that needs our help, we're there for them.
Yeah. And so at capacity, are you able to put folks somewhere else in the event that they do need the help?
Oh, go ahead, Julie.
Oh, go ahead, Kate. No, you go ahead.
We do actually have some other options. There have been some generous donations of places to stay. We have an entire team working very hard on that to make sure that everybody has a roof over their head, and even more importantly, a safe roof over their head, because what's happening now with the isolation of the virus is that the abuse has been escalating and to the point where people have to get out and get out now.
All right. And I've heard that there's been at least one lodging company that's provided some units that you're able to use free of charge.
Yes, that's correct. And we are very, very grateful to all of the community's help. It's been just amazing, the outpouring of understanding and help that we've gotten.
Yeah. So at capacity, have you had any problems with people sick with COVID in the Peace House?
We have not. We've been very stringently following the CDC and the local Summit County Health Department guidelines. They've been working very closely with us and helping us with access to personal protective equipment. About 75% of our staff are working remotely because we've invested in a telehealth system to provide some of our services at a distance safely. And so we've been very fortunate because of our strict adherence to these protocols. We haven't had a single case of COVID in the facility.
And any idea when some of the programs could return that you had to cancel due to the stay-at-home orders?
You know, I don't know. We're going to continue to operate out of an abundance of caution to keep our facility free of the virus. And so I don't think we really have any expectation of when that will change. Right now, it's actually working pretty well.
All right. All right. Anything else, ladies, you'd like to add?
Just encourage people to come out as soon as possible or the day of the event. You can come out today and make a donation through peacehouse.org. You can check back on the 7th for some fresh content. We're going to have some fun videos out there. And we really appreciate the encouragement that we've gotten from the community to proceed with this event in a virtual capacity. And we'll hope to see everybody at our spring luncheon next year.
Okay. Kate Margolis, Julie Joyce, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie.
KPCW News Time, now 8:39. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, Friday's Park City Business Roundtable focused on how the new county orders will impact recreation and trail use in Park City. Officials discussed the measures they're taking to make things as safe and sanitary as possible while easing up on the COVID restrictions. Registration for kid camps through the city programs opens this morning. KPCW's Carolyn Murray listened in and has this update.
Park City Mayor Andy Bierman opened the session explaining that the business roundtable, normally scheduled for Fridays, would be delayed a week. With the soft reopening of activities and businesses in Summit County, he hoped the Zoom meeting would bring a little lightness to what has been a challenging couple of months. Park City Recreation Manager Ken Fisher said the Municipal Athletic and Recreation Center facility, known as the MARC, would be opening in the coming days. He says they've taken advantage of the six-week closure to resurface several tennis courts, repaint the entire inside of the facility, polish up the lobby, and refinish the gym floor. He said there will be summer camps for kids in most programs, but they'll incorporate all the social distancing and sanitation requirements.
Where swim lessons are one that we are be working with the health department to try to get going for July. Currently in the health order, the leisure pool is closed. And with the whole social distancing, it's a challenge. But our aquatic staff has been creative and has come up with some great ideas. Get swim lessons operational where it may be a parent has to be in the water with their kid.
Golf manager Vaughn Robinson said the municipal course is now open and ready for play. He said things will run differently in the shop this year. He's researched and visited other courses around the state to determine best practices in this time of COVID.
We are back in action. The last month isn't too different than what we would normally do throughout the summer just or the winter because we've been closed. So it's, you know, putting the shop back together. That's been a little different, just spreading out all of the merchandise, trying to keep touch points down to a minimum. People aren't going to be able to shop when they normally come in here like they would in the past. They're going to have to have the staff come out and show them the shirt or the golf bag or shoes.
Robinson said they haven't yet designed the kids' golf camps for this summer. They're working on it, but he says it may not start until July or August. The Junior League will run every Monday afternoon. They have established ways to maintain proper COVID distancing guidelines. Mountain Trails Executive Director Charlie Sturgis is famous for his 10 seconds of kindness mantra. He encouraged trail users to add social distancing to their trail etiquette. He reminded people to pick up after their dogs and try to keep them away from those who are not in their own group. Sturgis said the Young Riders summer camps start next month. All the camps are full, but he's been impressed with how many families are using the trails together.
Whole families riding, out hiking, and you're just seeing this entire family group where typically this time of year, you wouldn't see that at all. You know, you'd be, kids would be in school, moms are running around, dads are trying to squeak a ride in.
Library Director Adrian Herrick-Juarez said kids are plowing through stacks of books, and with the new curbside checkout service, patrons can access books 6 days a week from their vehicles.
You're going to be able to go online to the library's website and look at our card catalog, be able to request all of your books online, and then our staff will be in the building pulling those, and you can drive right up, just like you would get your groceries, that touchless system of picking up groceries. We're going to do the same with books, so your kids can get those stacks of books again, which will be so helpful to have in the house when they're not out on the trails or doing the other activities. You can sit in the evenings and read a nice stack of books. When they are returned, we'll go into our book drop, and they will be quarantined and sanitized.
Links to the city's recreation programs and mountain trails can be found on kpcw.org. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Well, Midway Boosters announced Saturday they will be canceling Swiss Days this year. The organization said their decision was due to COVID-19 and came under the direction of the Wasatch Health Department. Swiss Days has been an annual tradition in Midway since the 1940s. According to the state tourism website, visitutah.com, the festival is the second largest in Utah after Pioneer Day, and 100,000 people come to Midway every September for the event. The festival began as a harvest celebration, then turned into an event that honors the Swiss pioneers who settled in the Heber Valley. Swiss Days is a two-day event that features a parade, a 10K race, arts and crafts booths, food, and entertainment. Midway Boosters is a nonprofit organization that puts on Swiss Days and uses the funds raised from the festival for community projects such as open space initiatives, remodeling the historic Midway Town Hall, and even buying a portable defibrillator for the Wasatch County first responders to help save the lives of heart attack and stroke victims. This year's Swiss Days was scheduled for September 4th and 5th. As of Saturday in Wasatch County, there have been 156 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Seven people have been hospitalized, and one person in the county has died from the virus. 8:45 now. Good morning. Well, with the Summit County stay-at-home order now lifted, the Christian Center of Park City is reopening of sorts today. On the phone with details, I have the executive director of the Christian Center, Rob Harder. Good morning, Rob.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. So tell us what that means, that you are reopening. It sounds like actually a soft opening.
Exactly. Yes, it is. Just, you know, we're trying to follow the health department guidelines as much as possible, and also just to reintegrate, you know, our full staff into their normal, you know, places of work. You know, we think I've shared many times on the radio that we transitioned a lot of our staff into food pantry, primarily helping with basic needs assistance. And so now we're going back to our normal schedule of getting them back to their areas where they normally work. So yeah, so we're opening. You know, we have different times. So I encourage you, you know, I sent an email to everybody. It's going to be on our website as well. But just so people that are listening, we are going to be open. For, of course, our pantries remain open, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. like normal. However, it's no longer going to be a drive-in. So we're not going to have that drive-through. And then the receiving, I know you asked about that. That's part of the biggest change. We are going to be open for receiving. It's going to be open from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Today, Monday through Saturday, so 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., both in Heber and Park City. So it depends where you're listening. You may want to drop off to Heber. But we just want to let you know, we expect a huge response. And so we honestly, just give us patience. There'll probably be a line. If you are not desperate with dropping off your things, I encourage you to wait later this week or even into next week, just because we have a sense it's going to be extremely busy and our hours are somewhat limited because, again, we're trying to do that soft opening and get back to a full opening here soon.
Okay, Monday through Saturday in Park City, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday in Heber City, then again for 4 hours.
Thanks for clarifying. That is correct. That's right. Tuesday and Thursdays we're not open in Heber. That's right.
Okay, so do you have room to put all of this stuff?
You know, we did. They did a lot of good job of just cleaning things out. And then because we have trucks, we're able to load a lot of things onto our trucks. And then Heber is not nearly as busy typically with receiving. Now, that may change right now. And so there's more space in Heber as well. So between the two stores and our trucks, we're able to provide most of it. Now, having said that, Leslie, you know, we may just get pounded. I think we will, actually. We have some great connections in Salt Lake, and we've already made arrangements if we need to do some offsite storage just temporarily again, just to store it until we can process through all of it.
Okay. And as you know, people have been doing a lot of cleaning. What is it that they should be bringing you? I mean, what maybe more specifically, what should they not bring you?
That's a great question. I would say what they shouldn't bring us are things that we can't immediately turn around and put into our stores. You know, that's the key, you know, because our stores will be open, by the way. And so the key is, you know, that we can get things to the store and start moving through all that inventory, which we have, of course, switched to spring and summer. So anything spring and summer, we'd love to have that because we can just turn that around and we can, you know, of course, sell it in our stores and or give it away to our thrift store. Which is often what we use with people that need clothes or need different items, then we can just give it to them for free through our thrift store. So that's what we need the most. And so anything that doesn't fall into that category that we really can't turn around to a store, I would say hold on to that.
Hang on to your winter clothing, basically, right?
Yeah, at this point, yes. Eventually, we'll take it. Of course, we love it because, you know, we live in a mountain town, so eventually we'll love it. But maybe the first 2 weeks, it would be wonderful if we can just stick with those things we can turn around. That would help our team quite a bit.
Okay, and in the past, you have offered pickups at people's houses, but you're not going to be able to do that yet?
Not yet, simply just because, yeah, we feel like we're going to be hammered at our locations. We just want to make sure we're giving good service as much as we can. And then our goal right now is within the first 2 weeks, again, assuming everything works as well as we hoped, then we'll go back to doing pickups and we get to get a brand to your house. So, yeah, so if you're not eager to get out and you could wait a couple of weeks, we'll be happy to come to your place and pick it up.
Great. And let's talk a little bit more about the food pantry. As you mentioned, it is no longer a drive-through, so clients will be able to come into the pantry to choose what they like?
That is correct. Kind of. It's a modified thing. So, in other words, as opposed to a drive-through, they are going to be able to come in one at a time. We are going to still provide them with a box of food and a few more items. So we're going to put some plexiglass in when you first check in, just for, you know, protection, just like a lot of retail stores are going to do. But they can't quite do shopping like grocery shopping yet. Eventually we'll get there because that's, as you know, that's what we did before. But we're not quite ready for that. Again, going back to what we read through the guidelines, it felt like part of the soft opening would be, for us anyway, the food pantry, is to not quite go to that level, but to have them be able to come in. There's a little bit more interaction that way. Our staff's going to wear, you know, masks and gloves, and then we are encouraging all customers to come in with the mask at least, and then they can let us know what they need. But it's still going to be a box of food, here's your food, as opposed to walking through and opening all the refrigerators and freezers. We're not quite ready for that. But again, as long as the health department feels good over time, we'd like to move back to that because it's certainly, I think, it's a little bit more enjoyable for the customer. And we just want to make sure we do it in the most safe way as possible.
Okay. The food pantry, though, requires an appointment, and people can do that by going online?
And that is correct. That's right. So just go online, just like they've done before. Actually, I feel like our community's done a really good job of responding to that. So just go online, sign up for Heber or Park City, and it'll give you a slot. It's every 15 minutes, and just let us know how many people in your family and when you'd like to come. And then we're going to give the first four parking spaces right next to our pantry for pantry guests, and that way they can park, you know, spend hopefully, you know, 10, 15 minutes, get their food, and be on their way.
Okay. I guess we should mention, too, I mean, the pick, you know, people dropping off their used goods, that's happening 10 to 2, but both the thrift store and the boutique will be open as well, 11 to 4?
That is correct. Yeah, thanks for mentioning. Yeah, so we're going to be open, so 11 to 4. I know a lot of people have been pent up not only to drop off things, but also to do some shopping and get back to some normalcy. So, yes, we'll be open 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. in both Park City and Heber. Same thing, we ask everyone to wear a mask, you know, as they come in. We are going to have someone stationed at the front of the stores just to make sure that, you know, we only allow a certain amount of people. Part of the health department order was no more than 20 people, you know, gathered at one time. So we're going to have just a controlled amount of people coming into the store. And then as one person leaves, we're going to let another one in, that kind of thing. Our staff will also be wearing masks and gloves as well. So, yeah, but if you're ready to do some shopping, we're going to do it, keep it as clean and as safe as possible. We encourage you to stop by. I mean, the nice thing is some of you love getting great deals. And because we've not been open for a while, there's going to be some great deals initially as we've the one thing over this break, stores team were able to get through all the winter, put it away, and then put all of the spring and summer new items out on the shelves. So we encourage you to come out if you feel comfortable.
All right. In terms of being able to feed people through the food pantry, numbers, again, holding pretty steady. It looks like maybe just a slight decrease.
Exactly. Yeah, it was interesting. It was a slight decrease. Yeah, we were pretty much at 1,000 on average each week for the last 6 weeks. And last week it dropped a bit. It was just a bit under 800. And, you know, it's funny. I talked to my team. I wondered why. We're not totally sure why, except really the real clear difference is we had a lot of international students that were still here, basically in a sense trapped. You know, they couldn't get home to Peru or Argentina. And I think it was Paraguay. Those are the three main countries. And some of them were able to go home. So we had a lot of them coming through on a weekly basis that are no longer there. So I think that was part of it. But it's been pretty steady. Like you said, 6 weeks in a row of about 1,000 individuals we've served. So we'll see if that fluctuates or if it stays the same. I guess time will tell. And as you mentioned, you know, it depends on how quickly we can get back on our feet and the economy, you know, cranking again. I think it's going to take some time, but we're certainly here and available, and we want people to use the food pantry as long as they need it.
That was such an interesting story about the international students basically stuck here. Their borders were closed. So those borders reopened, or did it take some, you know, government intervention?
That is a good question. What we understand is it was they finally reopened their borders, for them to allow them to come back. And initially it was just completely shut down. They didn't let anybody into the country from the United States. And so there was quite a bit of interaction, you know, between the agency that brought them here and their parents. And I'll have to give a shout out to the Park City community and Deer Valley and some others who really just kind of opened their doors to these students. I know that Deer Valley, as one example, gave them free housing while they were here. And we heard, because we, as you know, we've worked quite a bit with these international students, we get to know the parents sometimes. And as we understand, the parents actually would rather stay here in Park City, where they at least had a safe place to stay, rather than some people have tried to venture to Miami, because most of them, that's wherever the flight was to their home country, usually left from Miami. And there was reports of a lot of people in Miami stuck and not really a good place to stay. Whereas Park City, there was a safe place. We had food for them. You know, the community rallied around them. We had many people come to us and said, hey, we'll open up our house. If you need the students to stay at our house, we'll be willing to do that. So I felt like we really did a great job of just welcoming those students even while they were stuck.
Yeah, and they likely extended the dates of their visa. Hopefully that doesn't come back to prevent them from coming back.
That is a great question. I'm not sure how that's going to work. Yeah, I don't know. That's a total government question, and I certainly hope they give them a little bit more flexibility. And just one note, I was really interesting. We had one couple that came to the food pantry last week, and they're actually already here for the summer. They had already arrived, which is really odd, but they arrived. And of course, then their job was canceled. So, but they're supposed to be here for the next 6 months, approximately 5 to 6 months. So they're kind of stuck here, and they're not sure if they go back or do they stay, even though they don't have a job. So that's also the reverse is kind of an awkward situation. Luckily, there's not many of those, because most of them were, you know, stuck before the summer season started. So I was a little surprised that they were already here early, it seemed like.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the basic needs assistance that is continuing. You have worked through the first group of applications. So how many people received help in that first round?
Yeah, so we are still going through it. But, so far we've dispersed funds to about 375 families. Just so you know the process, so we have had, you know, a tremendous amount of applications. You know, we're almost at 800 people, that 800 families, let's just say, that applied. So they're all in various stages. So it's a really kind of a dynamic process. So, for example, some people applied a month ago and some people applied yesterday. And so those are all considered first time applicants. So that's why there's an interesting, I mean, just a lot of people we still have to go through. But because we've gone through that first group of people and we continue to obviously get new first time requests, many people that already received rent for April now, and now we're into May, have asked for rent in May. And so we did start a second round of those who already, you know, have been in the system, if you will, for a month, and they did get payment, and now they're ready for another payment. We just felt like we needed to keep offering that to them because, again, people need to pay for the rent. So, so we have started that process, and we're continuing to work through it. We'll see how long it goes. I don't know if this is going to be something where, you know, as you mentioned, the doors are opening, so to speak, to our economy, but I think it's going to be a slow return. So this is going to be, I think, a process that's going to be with us for a while.
Yeah. So do you think you'll be able, do you have the resources to help all 800 applicants?
That's our goal right now. We do have enough money. Again, thanks to the amazing generosity of this community, we've raised over $500,000. So I know one of your questions to me was, like, how much do you think we need per round, so to speak? And again, that number keeps changing of who comes in as first round, but we feel like about 300,000, you know, on a conservative number, if we help every single person on average about 450 per family. By the way, when they apply, we end up, you know, having a series of questions for them, and often we find out that maybe a husband applied and the wife, and we try just to help, you know, one family at a time. And so some of those numbers, as we go through the process, they'll drop. So anyway, the conservative number, though, would be 300,000, I think, for one round. And so if we do a second round for everybody, that's another 300,000. We've got enough funds for that. The third round is a big question mark. We don't have enough funding yet. And you asked the question, too, will even people need it? I don't know. I think they probably will, just because, again, it's not going to turn around on a dime with our economy. But yeah, right now we can only give what we have in terms of our funding.
Okay. Finally, I wanted to ask, how did Saturday's food drive go? And how was it split between you and St. Mary's Food Bank?
Yeah, it was so great. I want to give a shout-out to Park City Rotary, John Hanrahan, Candace Hart. I mean, the whole crew. It was just great to see them out there. It was kind of fun to be outside, and everyone was doing a great job with their masks. And we did collect about two truckfuls. So we have not get the final number in terms of the poundage, but two truckfuls is quite a bit. That's going to serve, you know, a lot of people through that food. And, yeah, so with St. Mary's, we'll take about two-thirds, and they'll take about a third, simply because they just don't have as many people that they serve through their food pantry. But we're happy to share it. And, yeah, so we're going to split it between the two of ours. And we're really thankful for people coming out on a Saturday and giving food. And I think for a lot of people, it's just fun to, even though you saw them with their masks on, it was fun to see some people's faces.
Sure. And why no green beans? That was a request from the Christian Center.
Well, yes, we got a ton. It's funny. It is kind of, it's like, why green beans of all things? Well, sometimes we do. We get food from Utah Food Bank, and then it's often a USDA, you know, down trickle down through the Utah Food Bank, which then comes to us. We've had a ton of green beans for whatever reason. I don't know why. So we're like, we don't need any more green beans, but there's other items that we do need. So that's why we simply put in there, because we just had an abundance of green beans.
Okay. Hey, Rob, leave it there. But again, people still can contact the Counseling Center. You're still offering free sessions to new clients through the month of May.
Yes, that's correct, all the way till June 1st. So we okay. Definitely encourage people to check out our Counseling Center.
Okay. Rob, thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, thank you, Leslie. Appreciate it. Take care.
It's Rob Harder, Executive Director of the Christian Center of Park City. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. Coming up, we've got headline news followed by Mountain Money. Currently 37 degrees here in Old Town Park City, looking for sunshine and a high of 56. This has been the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Leslie Thatcher. See you tomorrow.